Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I love the Southeast Asian coffees because they have a very rich, robust, complex flavor. If you were going to compare it to a wine, it's like a very rich, full-bodied red wine.
Catherine Tucker loves coffee so much, she's also studying it. In today's edition of Food School, she talks all about the things to consider when buying a bag of coffee beans. She mentioned wine. Harvest Public Media reports that some Midwest vineyards are being devastated by pesticide drift. Back to coffee, we visit a local roaster who walks us through the tricky process of getting beans perfectly browned. And coffee in the marinade. Daniel Orr makes some stunning barbecued spare ribs. Looking at what's going on in food news, here's Luann Johnson.
Food waste is still the thing to talk about in food circles. Perhaps it's because of a new study by the Natural Resources Defense Council and Harvard Law School's Food Law and Policy Clinic. It says many consumers are throwing away food before it's spoiled. This is in part due to confusion over the dates stamped on the food labels. Use-by typically means a product is freshest before that date. Meanwhile, sell-by means that although a store won't sell after that date, customers can still expect the product purchased to be safe to eat for a period of time after buying. Those labels are meant as an indication of food quality, not as a hard and fast rule for food safety. Currently, with the exception of baby formula, there is no national standard for date stamps on food. Congress has attempted to pass laws standardizing food dates since 1973. The most recent campaign came in the form of the Freshness Disclosure Act, which is currently being redrafted by Representative Nita Lowey of New York. But don't hold your breath. This bill was originally introduced in 1999. You might be surprised by who's spearheading a new initiative to convert food waste into energy. Kroger, America's largest supermarket chain. The Kroger Recovery System breaks down old food through anaerobic digestion to produce biogas. Anaerobic digestion is the naturally occurring decomposition process that releases carbon dioxide in an oxygen-free environment that is transformed into methane for energy. The waste converter system will be installed at one of their main distribution centers in Compton, California. According to the website Food Tank, it will decrease the plant's carbon emissions by 90,000 tons each year. And another ingenious way to get something good out of expired food. Cook it, repackage it, and sell it for cheap. Daily Table is the brainchild of Doug Rowe, the former president of Trader Joe's. Instead of throwing out overstocked items that are past their sell-by dates, or produce that is cosmetically blemished, the food will be cooked at what he's calling a restaurant-grocery store hybrid. Rowe told NPR's Scott Simon that the idea is to offer the food at prices that compete with fast food. Find links to these stories in this week's podcast post. That's on the website eartheats.org.
Connect with us on Twitter and Facebook to get even more food news and recipes throughout the week. Search for, of course, Earth Eats. Always a pleasure, Luann Johnson.
See you next week, Annie.
Across the Midwest, states are promoting the wine industry as a way to boost tourism and economic development in rural areas. But as vineyards move in next door to long-standing fields of corn or soybeans, they don't always make good neighbors. Occasionally, herbicides sprayed by farmers and others drift beyond their intended target. As Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media reports, for nearby vineyards, the results can be devastating.
We start out with Frontenac Gris. Save All. Save All's a white.
Tom Zumpf is showing me around his vineyard near the town of Eagle in eastern Nebraska. It's quiet and secluded down among the grapevines. That's one reason Zumpf and his partner Kathleen started this ambitious retirement project.
We put our first plants in 2006, close to 16 acres, and we're probably the fourth or fifth largest vineyard in the state.
It's called Dove Landing Vineyard. At least that's what they'll call it when it opens. They were supposed to start making wine last year, but now their plans are on hold. Zumpf holds up a vine with pale, shriveled leaves.
Well, you see this leaf right here looks like it's had hot water poured on it. And that's a 2,4-D signature type of damage.
2,4-D is a common herbicide used by farmers because it kills weeds but doesn't kill their corn. Landscapers and golf courses use it a lot. Highway crews often spray it on road ditches. Lowell Sandell is a weed scientist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
Unfortunately, it just so happens that grapes are very sensitive to small amounts of 2,4-D, or they can be.
The problem isn't direct spray, it's herbicide drift. Drift can happen with any weed killer. A stiff breeze can carry tiny droplets from the sprayer in one field to the vineyard next door. But 2,4-D and another chemical called dicamba remain a threat for drift up to 2 days after they're sprayed. If it's hot out, they can evaporate and take to the wind.
Those products are capable of moving off-site in vapor form. That's not a characteristic of a lot of the other herbicides used in corn and soybean production.
Last year, Zumpf was hit. 2,4-D drifted in and left his vines taking on that scalded look. It was one of 75 drift cases reported last year to the Nebraska Department of Agriculture. This year, it happened again. He's lost 2 years of harvest. No grapes, no wine.
We thought we were going to lose about half of our vineyard. The plants looked so bad. We had about a $600,000 loss in sales.
Grape and vegetable growers across the country are concerned drift could be an even greater threat to their farms in the future. Monsanto and Dow AgroSciences are developing soybeans that are resistant to 2,4-D or dicamba in addition to the herbicide Roundup. It's a way of getting past Roundup-resistant weeds. Along with the new seeds, there will be new formulations of 2,4-D and dicamba, which the companies have said will reduce drift. Lowell Sandell says that depends on how careful you are.
They will probably certainly be better, but any time you apply a pesticide, there's drift potential, and that's why folks want to take the most care they can.
Nebraska grape growers are seeking extra reassurance. A bill in the state legislature would have created buffer zones around vineyards where farmers would need permission before spraying 2,4-D or dicamba. That would basically make the new soybeans irrelevant. It was a big request from a small industry. The bill stalled, but the Agriculture Committee is studying the drift issue this fall. Jeff Wilmus, general manager of Kaup Seed and Fertilizer, says most drift problems can be solved just by being a better neighbor.
If you're a good neighbor with that vineyard, you'll work around when's going to be the best time to spray if you're going to be close around those vineyards.
Kaup Seed does contract spraying in northeast Nebraska. Before they spray, they go to Drift Watch, a website where vineyards can map their fields. If something is close by, they call ahead and make sure the wind is blowing the right way. But Wilmus says grape growers should also be aware of their surroundings. Nebraska's 30 wineries cover a few hundred acres, while corn and beans cover millions.
The agriculture was here first, and so they need to have a little bit of an understanding of that there will be some of these events happening, and spraying and fertilizing and that whole process that goes with production agriculture.
It exposes that fruit to sunlight.
This should be harvest season back at Dove Landing Vineyard, but Tom Zumpf says any grapes that grow this year are being thrown away to allow the vines to reserve their energy. With time, they can work through the effects of drift, and Zumpf plans to do the same.
We're in it for the long haul. Instead of planting for the year, we plant for decades. These plants, typically they'll live 50, 75 years, something like that. They could be here for a long, long time. As long as we can keep them healthy, they will be.
The 2,4-D and dicamba-resistant soybeans are perhaps another 2 years away from federal approval. In the meantime, grape and vegetable growers in the Midwest will push regulators for tougher drift rules and ask their neighbors to look before they spray. I'm Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media at harvestpublicmedia.org. If you're listening to me right now in the morning, there's a 60% chance that you have a cup of coffee in your hand right now. Or maybe you like a decaf double soy latte from your local coffee shop. You and all the other specialty coffee drinkers in the U.S. spend about $18 billion a year on frou-frou coffee beverages. But today, it's not about our caffeine addictions or how much money coffee shops are making off us. It's about the growers, the people at the very beginning of the process. Catherine Tucker is an associate professor of anthropology at Indiana University, and she works with coffee growers in Honduras and Guatemala. She's reeled in her coffee consumption over the years.
There have been times in my life where it's probably been closer to 8, but right now I'm about 1.
Only one cup a day. There's no way. She sees studying coffee as a way of understanding larger challenges we face as consumers in a very complex world. I chatted with her for our Food School series. It's all the mind-expanding joy of college with none of that pesky homework.
I love the Southeast Asian coffees because they are lower in acid. They have a very rich, robust, complex flavor. And if you were going to compare it to a wine, it's like a very rich, full-bodied red wine. And that's my favorite cup of wine, and that's my favorite cup of coffee.
Can you describe how the bean that produces that coffee is grown?
I do try to buy coffee that has been produced organically. That implicitly means that it's also been shade grown. Most of the, say, the Sumatran coffees, I love Sumatran coffee, and also like the Ethiopian Sidamo, are still processed by traditional means in which the coffee bean is dried with the cherry on it. There's only a few places in the world where that actually works well, because in most places it is too humid for coffee beans to dry without fungus growing on it during the drying process. So you have to get the cherry off right away before it starts to ferment. But for Arabica coffees, there's these select places where you've got the sun-dried coffee, and those have a richer flavor. They also have the advantage of using less water for processing and being a bit easier on the environment.
Let's backtrack a little bit. The crux of your talk, or at least what I got from it, was that shade-grown coffee is better, just generally. Why don't all coffee growers grow shade-grown coffee if it's better?
Shade-grown coffee tends to have lower levels of productivity and requires greater inputs of labor, because you have to substitute chemicals used in sun-grown coffee with human labor. Sun-grown coffee requires chemical inputs. So you have chemical fertilizer, pesticides, herbicides, nematicides, fungicides that all need to be administered, and they cause health problems for the workers who administer them, usually have minimal or no protection. And then you have all of those chemicals running off into water sources and getting into the soil. Then the other aspect of sun-grown coffee, of course, is that it completely destroys biodiversity.
I don't know if I've ever seen a coffee labeled as shade-grown. Is this something that I should be looking for now as a coffee consumer?
There are some that are shade-grown. If you buy the Smithsonian bird-friendly coffee, that's obviously shade-grown because it has the trees so that the migratory songbirds can nest in them and have habitat. And as I said, most organic coffee, in fact, to my knowledge, all organic coffee has to be grown in shade, because organic coffee grown in sun is basically an impossibility. The coffee trees won't produce without some kind of extra boost from fertilizers, and it's really only the chemical fertilizers that have the concentrated nutrients that would be necessary to sustain coffee in pure sun.
More with Catherine Tucker in the second half of our show. Next step in the coffee process, roasting. That's the key for creating the desirable flavor and aroma of your cup of joe. As with most crafts, the more time and care you take with roasting, the better the product. That's what micro-roasting is all about. Micro-roasteries process small batches of coffee beans to exact specifications. The beans are air-dried, not doused with water like they do in commercial operations. This all results in a much fresher product than the alternative.
I just made a fresh pot of coffee, but I don't use sugar or cream, so it's black, but you can help yourself.
Thank you.
S.K. Quigley is the man behind Partridge and Quigley Coffee Roasting Company in Bloomington, Indiana. A veteran of the restaurant business, he took up coffee roasting in Denver and quickly realized he had both a passion and a taste for it. Micro-roasted coffee wasn't anything like the stuff he grew up with.
The coffee that I was exposed to as a younger person came out of can. You know, Maxwell House, Folgers, what was the one out of New York? A chock full of nuts. And it was a coffee that, my God, if you didn't add cream and sugar to it, it just wasn't very tolerable.
He's converted a double garage into his roasting facility, where he prepares beans every day of the week except Friday. The one old-school machine he uses is at the far end, surrounded by bags and bags of raw coffee beans.
This is a Sumatran coffee.
Oh, it's darker.
Darker green. Then you can look at a Guatemalan.
Yeah, much lighter.
Yeah, it's kind of a gray-green. And then you can see a Colombian bean, which is lighter yet.
He's using some of each of these beans in the breakfast blend he's roasting this morning. Quigley is at the key point in the roasting process right now, where he releases the freshly roasted beans from the roasting chamber into the cooling tray. Allowing the beans to heat even 2 degrees too much would mean disaster.
I'm right on the very end of the roast, and I'm kind of monitoring it. We're going to drop this at 400 degrees.
398, 397. Yeah. 99, 400.
And if you look in the inside of this roaster, looks like a washing machine. It's got those fins in it. And those fins keep the bean from hitting the side of the roaster where they would scorch. You're wanting to float these beans in the hot air. When you pull anything out in this mass, you can hear it still crackling. I'm trying to pull the temperature down as quickly as possible so the roast remains at the point that I want it to remain. And it, I'm pushed air from the roasting chamber onto this cooling tray. This temperature will drop down from the point that I pulled the coffee almost 200 plus degrees.
Gosh, I was thinking the roastery would smell like coffee, but it doesn't really smell like coffee yet. I'm getting a little bit of the aroma, yeah, but not much.
No. If I took this out and served it to you straight from the cooling tray, just wouldn't have much to it. Once this is roasted, for one day, we do not use it. It has to outgas. The second and third day are better for a roasted coffee. And it takes that period of time, that 24 hours, to pull itself together. It's kind of like when you make a soup. It's always better the second day.
Photos of S.K. Quigley in action, those are posted at eartheats.org. Coming up, coffee in the marinade.
So you can use any of your favorite chili rubs and then add a little bit of ground espresso, and what that does is it gives it kind of a smoky roasted flavor, and it really permeates the meat.
Spare ribs. Chef Daniel Orr bellies up to the grill next. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. We'll continue talking about the ethics of coffee with Catherine Tucker in 2 minutes. But let's cook with coffee right now. Spare ribs from Kiss My Grass Farm in Morgantown, Indiana, will be lathered with espresso-infused marinade. Chef Daniel Orr is getting it all started.
What I'm doing today is actually spare ribs. So these are from the belly of the pork. And this is from, heritage pork. You can see this compared to other different types of pork, this is fairly meaty and lean. And what I'm going to do is a very simple marinade. Now, what I do is I take a Ziploc bag, and this keeps it really clean, very little mess. Okay, I'm going to put my spare ribs in there. Now, what I've done is I've added a little of my Columbus Cowboy spice rub, but it's basically a chili rub that I add some espresso to. So you can use any of your favorite chili rubs and then add a little bit of ground espresso. And what that does is it gives it kind of a smoky, roasted flavor, and it really permeates the meat. Just going to shake that around, kind of like a, shake and bake, mama. And I helped. Okay. And then then I'm going to add some of my Big Belly barbecue rub. Never trust a skinny chef. So I'm going to, this would be about three to four portions of spare ribs, depending if you're having it as an appetizer or a main course. I probably added about a half cup of the chili espresso rub and about a cup of the barbecue. Okay, now what I'm going to do is just really rub that around so it coats everything. And then I'll put that in the fridge overnight. Okay, and then the next day, what I do is I take it back to the back of the kitchen. At home, what you could do is you could set up a bamboo steamer. If you know what that is, it's a wok that you put the bamboo, round bamboos in. And it's what you steam vegetables in, or meat or dumplings. And so you could use that at home. And then what you're going to do is you're going to steam this for about 90 minutes. And what that does is it allows the meat to get really, really tender without having, let's say, a smoke pit. And also it's a very healthy way of doing that instead of getting a lot of smoke in it. I'll put this guy in, set it for 90.
We can leave that meat to steam while we check back in with Catherine Tucker. She's been conducting research in Honduras and Guatemala for 20 years with a focus on coffee for the last 10. She's part of a collaborative project studying whether fair trade certification results in better economic situations for coffee producers. She says determining an empirically defensible estimate of coffee production was not easy.
And that meant counting every bean on certain plants. So, yes.
How many coffee beans grow on a plant?
That depends on the plant. There's some branches that have 300 coffee beans and some that have 10.
In the first half of the show, we talked about what the organic label on coffee means. Well, what about fair trade? Apparently, that's a much larger conversation because Tucker says not all fair trade labels are created equal. And there's a great deal of debate right now about what fair trade really means.
I prefer the companies that guarantee 100% fair trade coffee because that means that every bean in that coffee has been purchased from fair trade certified farmers. It also means that the company itself is following the principles of fair trade and social equity in its business practices. And one of the biggest problems for people who are concerned about the implications of the inequities in our global economic system is that fair trade coffee is often bought by companies that are then paying their workers poorly, maybe not following any environmentally green practices in their own factories or processing plants or distribution centers. And so the 100% fair trade companies are embracing a whole suite of social justice and environmental sustainability values. And that's not to say that it's not good, but it's more of a question of finding out what those labels are actually requiring and what values they're respecting.
I'm sure when you give this information to students, they think, I have to stop drinking coffee. This is far too complicated. I can't be an ethical coffee drinker because there are just too many issues here. What do you tell them?
I say don't stop drinking coffee because there's 25 million coffee growers on this planet that depend on people buying coffee. So instead, consider making wiser coffee choices by buying coffee that has been produced in ways that are more environmentally sustainable, like the organic shade-grown approaches, and are more likely to support social justice because they pay the farmers better. And of course, one of the biggest problems that I don't think I've mentioned yet in talking to you right now is that most coffee farmers are barely making it because they're getting so little for the coffee that they grow. While in the conventional markets, a few very large transnational corporations dominate the purchasing, and they are making more and more money. They've been essentially getting windfall profits for the past 15 to 20 years and have been driving prices lower for coffee farmers. I think that coffee is really interesting, and I also see it as a way for understanding some of the larger challenges that we face as consumers in a very complex world.
Awesome, thanks.
You're welcome.
Catherine Tucker is an associate professor of anthropology at Indiana University. Next week's Food School will be with Peter Todd, professor of psychological and brain sciences. All the choices we have in our food world, he'll talk about how we figure out what to eat. All right, back to the spare ribs. After they soaked in the marinade and were steamed for 90 minutes, the meat should be falling off the bones. Then, to get the outside caramelized and crispy, put them either on the grill or under a broiler or in a hot grill pan.
You can see we've got some nice caramelization here. I'm going to put that on the plate. We've got a little bit of our Caribbean slaw, some potato salad, a little bit of avocado. I've taken that sauce out of the bag. And then to decorate it today, we're going to use some star fruit. Are you familiar with star fruit?
I am. Love the stuff.
All right. So it's got a really nice kind of citrusy flavor. It's also called a charambula. And then another thing I like to do with ribs is to put a little bit of toasted coconut on them.
Why with the coconut?
It sticks to the sauce, and then it just is a little crunchiness and kind of a sweet crunchiness on the pork. You could also throw a piece of orange on there. I like to have a little piece of citrus next to my barbecue because you can get the grease off your finger. Also, it's kind of a nice palate cleanser.
Tell me how I would incorporate the avocado when I'm eating this dish.
Well, you could mash that in with your slaw just kind of use it as a... Depending on how spicy you like your barbecue sauce, if you have a real spicy barbecue sauce, that would be kind of a cleansing, cooling, fatty flavor that would go along with the barbecue. All right, so there we go, and that is our Columbus Cowboy pork barbecue.
Grilling season won't be here for much longer, so make this recipe while you can. Step-by-step instructions on our website. Oh, and that Caribbean coleslaw that he mentioned? Find that recipe as well at eartheats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Boy, after this episode, we're all hopped up on coffee and ready to go. Have a good one. I'm Annie Corrigan.